Hey guys, this is Christine Blackburn, and I want to personally thank you for listening to Storyworthy. The only way we can get the word out is word of mouth. So if you could please tell your friend, family member, or coworker about the Storyworthy podcast, we can keep this train rolling.
And we thank you very much.
This episode of Storyworthy is brought to you by GoDaddy.com. You can register your domain name now for only $2.95.
Yeah, that's right. GoDaddy is offering OneNew or Transfer.com for the very low price of $2.95.
Yeah, whether you're starting a new business, you just want to put your idea online, or you just want people to look at you because you need attention, you can make a new.com or you can transfer a .com for only $2.95.
And when you're over there at GoDaddy, enter the code STORY295 in the promo code at checkout, and then you are in fact supporting this podcast.
You'll get what you want. We'll get what we want.
Hey, it's Scott Boxenbaum, and you are listening to Storyworthy.
Welcome to the Storyworthy podcast. Here are your hosts, Christine Blackburn and Hannes Finn.
Storyworthy. My name is Christine Blackburn, and I'm here with
Hannes Finney. And we often take our mobile van to exact locations, but today we are taking the Storyworthy time machine of truth to travel to 1981 and go to Spago on Sunset Boulevard. Hi, Wolfgang. Oh, hello. How are you?
Wow,
it's Wolfgang Puck, ladies and gentlemen. He's here.
That was a very popular place in the 80s, Spago.
Yes, right down Sunset from the Comedy Store. Kind of in back, sort of above the Tower Records.
Because it's a hillside there.
Yeah.
And so Spago was up there. Very popular at the time, I remember, in a lot of the awards shows.
Yeah, at the time we are there, in, because we've traveled
right,
through a time
course.
Machine, yes.
But people would go to there before the awards show, after the awards show.
Yeah, you would just, it was the place to be seen.
Yeah, and then Wolfgang Puck spun off and did, you know, my gosh, he's got all sorts of stuff.
I remember when he had restaurants, or he will in the future, in the 90s, have restaurants all over the country, Wolfgang Puck cafes. That will abate somewhat in the 2000s.
He'll have his own frozen food.
But he still has, yes, he still will have frozen food. And, you know, he will not age a bit.
I just heard a comedian talking about Wolfgang Puck, about how when he's talking on his cooking show, it sounds like Hitler. It's very hard to
look every time he says, and you mix in some gypsies, and it's like, really, Hitler? You put gypsies in every single episode.
And we have traveled back in time because our guest tonight, Scott Boxenbaum, he brings forth the topic growing up in the 80s in LA, or growing up in LA in the 80s,
right? Up in Milwaukee, as everyone knows, everyone in America knows,
of course,
and it's like. You think that L.A. and Hollywood are this mystical place that you can't even conceive of actually being there. And you don't realize people grew up there and feel the same way about show business, even if they're in Los Angeles.
Right.
And Kroll is a guy who talks about that all the time. It's like he's right fucking there, and he doesn't have any idea how to get into it.
He grew up in the Valley, I think, in Sherman Oaks or Van Nuys or somewhere. Yeah, and just because he grew up here in Los Angeles doesn't mean that he knew famous people or that he knew... Because it's like any other town. There's, you know, banking, and there's hospitals, and there's universities, and then there's show business. It's just another type of business in the city.
Yeah, exactly. So it just is like, well, looking at it from a distance was like... And of course, in the 80s, everyone was so crazy and wacky and you know...
Well, in the 80s, you know, it took, of course, before the internet, it took things longer to get to the East Coast, though. It seemed like fashion and style and music would kind of start out here in California and then trickle its way down.
Yeah, they used to say, you know, in Milwaukee, it's like you go to Chicago and you see what you'll be wearing in a year, and then you go to New York and you see what you'll be wearing in 5 years.
But now it's all monotonous. I mean, now all the stores put out the exact same clothes at the exact same time. But growing up in Pittsburgh, yeah, it was elusive. Los Angeles was elusive. And we just basically went to each other's houses after school. You know, as you remember, no parents were around in the 80s. We were all latchkey kids. Parents weren't in the picture. And so we would go to each other's houses and eat Doritos and M&Ms, Pepsi.
So your euphemism for... sex orgies.
That's exactly right. Yes. No, but as I got older in the 80s and in college and stuff, it was like drinking beer out of red Solo cups.
Why is that not changed, by the way? Up to 2014, in the distant future, people will still be drinking beer in college out of red Solo cups. Why? How did they get the monopoly on the only cup that you can drink cheap beer out of.
And now they have all sorts of solo cups. Now they've got like a clear cup. They've got like a, you know, a 4 ounce, a 6 ounce. There's a wine. There's a stem glass is what there is.
Yeah, but I'm not going to, you know,
if I have a
party, I'm buying the red ones. That's what's happening. Otherwise, it's not a party.
Yeah, so I don't know. For me, growing up in the 80s, it was incredibly not glamorous. And I didn't, you know, of course, nobody was in show business in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania.
Yeah, exactly.
And it was a very rural slash suburban kind of area.
Yeah, now, exactly.
When I think about my daughter, you know, she's 7. And so let's say within, 9 years, 8 years, she's a teenager. Am I supposed to just drop her off at the Hollywood Bowl with her little friends and let them go?
Apparently, that is what she'll be doing. No, she won't want you to drop them off. She'll be like, you can drop me off at the subway and I'll take the red line over there. And you'll be like, you're not riding a goddamn subway in this city. Back in my day.
Well, I don't know, because I think about driving in Los Angeles, and who is she going to get in a car with? And, you know,
but who is she going to get in a car with in rural Pennsylvania?
I don't know. But the idea of taking my daughter and her friends to like the Staples Center and dropping them off in downtown Los Angeles just seems crazy.
I know, but it seemed, you know, maybe we need a little more detachment like our parents had. Like, come back alive in the morning. That was all you got.
That was. It was like, I'm not asking, so don't tell me. Don't ask, don't tell. That's what it was like in my house as well.
Yeah, they just assumed that you weren't. But you know what? I think we always assumed that they didn't have any idea we were doing anything. But I realize now as an old man, they completely knew and just decided, what could they do about it?
Well, see, I just don't know, because the way I'm bringing my daughter up is so different than the way I was brought up.
Yeah.
I mean, in terms of, like, I feel like my daughter and I like a lot of the same things, and we can listen to the same, you know, watch some of the same shows and listen to the same music.
At some point, she will deliberately pretend to not like things you like so that she can rebel.
In other words, she's still so young. That's what you're saying.
When she's 14, even if she likes the same show you're watching, she's going to walk in and tell you it's stupid.
I see what you're saying. So at 7 years old is one thing, but when she's a teenager, it's a whole different thing.
Yeah, she will deliberately want to be separate.
I'm terrified. I really am. I'm terrified.
Look, you will have a much closer relationship with her than your mother had with you.
And you know what I'm going to do?
Not that hard.
If we have problems, I'm going to send her over to her Uncle Hannes.
Yeah, and I'll be,
you deal with it.
If you have trouble, if it's a bad boy, I'll be the guy who will be like, he'll be like, hey, and I'll be like, shut the fuck up.
Yeah, a bad boy in my daughter's life is called a dead man.
Yes. I will be. I'm getting trained at the theme park on how to deal with teenagers. Here's what you got to do. You're going to listen, shit for brains. I learned that from your dad.
Is that really?
It's a good phrase, because it stops people in their tracks. It's like you can't. People are like, well, you have to be respectful. You can't treat teenage boys with respect. Do not respond to it.
Now, let's put you in the context of what you're talking about. You work at Universal Studios up in Hollywood in the theme park. So you're talking about seeing 20 to 30,000 people a day, and you're talking about teenage boys.
And if there's 4 teenage boys coming up to take a picture with Dora the Explorer, and they're like, well, Dora's stupid, but they really want to take a picture, so they feel like they have to, you know, that you can just sense that they're going to be like, Dora's stupid, but I'll hit her or something, you know what I mean? Right. And so coming up, I'm just like, all right, boys, let's come up, stand next to you, stand over there. I start telling them what to do.
Yeah.
And I call them boys. Or if it's a one, I'm like, son.
Oh, which doesn't sound. You're really throwing on the heat.
Yeah.
I'm throwing on the son.
You have to.
So do you really say to them, like, you shit for brains? Or do you get really close?
That's only during Halloween Horror Nights.
So you get really close to them, I see.
No, I'll be, I've gone up to people and I'll be like, I will throw your ass out of this park.
Good for you.
Which I don't have the power to do, but they don't know that.
Right, they don't know that. Well, okay.
There's a reason that when you're a teenage boy, you don't understand why your dad. Well, my dad was crazy, but most people are like, my dad, he was so mean to me. He wasn't mean to you. If he wasn't stern and tell you what to do, you would have fucking driven a car off the top of a building. You were out of your fucking mind. You were a 14-year-old boy. You were just a raging pile of hormones and stupidity.
What is the Mark Twain quote? He says, when I was 14, I thought my father was...
was an idiot. I came back home at 24, I found out... I was amazed at how much he'd learned.
Yeah, or something like that.
I think it was different ages, but that was the basic idea.
Oh, yeah. My gosh. Well, there you go. If you're growing up in Los Angeles and you and your friends are going up to Universal, don't be surprised if you encounter Honus Finney.
Yes. I'm here for get off my lawn.
All right, you guys. We're going to bring our storyteller on in just 1 minute. But before we do that, I did want to mention that if you'd like to support Storyworthy, you should. And here's how you do it.
Well, you can go to storyworthypodcast.com. You can click on the Amazon link.
Yeah, that always works.
Normal things, and we get a little taste.
But the most important thing you can do, folks, is to tell your friends, your coworkers, and your family members about the Storyworthy podcast. It's called word of mouth. Have you heard of that?
Yeah, and don't give them elaborate instructions. You tell them either just go to storyworthypodcast.com or go to the Storyworthy Facebook page. Everybody's comfortable with Storyworthy. And you can click on one thing and go and listen to it. They don't have to download things if they're not apt. They're not good at that. There are people who are like, I have to do more than three clicks. I have to go to three windows. I'm not into that. It's like, no, you don't have to do that. Just go to the Facebook page. You click on one thing. You go to a page that lists that you, it'll play it. Just relax.
There you go. So
just
please.
Relax. Just tell your stupid friends to relax and like us.
It's a podcast. It's not a horror
film. Listen, shit for brains. When I tell you, no, but seriously, it's not that hard. People think it's hard. It's not that hard.
Also, you guys, you can follow us on Twitter at Storyworthy. And of course, you can email us anytime you want to, info@storyworthypodcast.com. And hey, if you have a little free time, head over to iTunes and leave us a good review. I shouldn't care about the reviews, but sometimes I do.
Well, it's hard not to. People love to be snarky, and we need some non-snarky people.
That's what we need. Exactly.
If you're not snarky, come on over to iTunes. If you're snarky, shit for brains, I will throw your ass out of this park.
All right, you guys, hang tight, because comedian Scott Boxenbaum is on his way here. Next time on Storyworthy, we have author Wally Rudolph.
And I'll be talking about killing a goose.
That's next time on Storyworthy.
Hi, this is Amber Tozer, and you're listening to Storyworthy.
And we're back. We have left Spago, and we are in Tower Records right now. And known by our previous storyteller,
Jim Wilson.
Jim Wilson. Michael Jackson is up in the office behind one-way glass watching us right now.
Now, that's true. We had a storyteller on, Jim Wilson. He's a guitar player and a musician, and he plays for a lot of different bands, including Mother Superior, and he backs up for Pearl A Day now. Right. Anyway, so yeah, Jim used to work here in Tower Records, and he became friends with Michael Jackson.
Michael Jackson would come, and just to look at people as normal people without them noticing him, he would go upstairs behind a one-way glass and watch people buy records.
Yeah, he just liked to watch people shop. I think that's fascinating.
It's
on last summer's episode of Storyworthy called Michael Jackson. So
yes, perhaps you should look at that. But before you do that, you're going to hear a fantastic story from Scott Boxenbaum.
All right, he's here right now, you guys. Scott Boxenbaum is a comic and a writer right here from Los Angeles, Hannes. You don't know a lot of people that are from Los Angeles, am I right?
There's only like five. I don't know how there's so many.
He has an MFA from USC Film School.
Ooh.
Now, who dropped out of USC Film School? Do you remember famously?
Either Spielberg or Lucas?
Jim Morrison.
Oh, right. They graduated from film school. That's right.
Scott also studied improv and sketch at the UCB Theater here in Los Angeles, and he's a regular at the Hollywood Improv. You can find him on Twitter at Scott Box. Did you hear that, Hannes? Scott Box.
Scott Box.
All right, folks, wherever you are, put your hands together for Scott Boxenbaum.
Thank you so much. So, as your fine host mentioned, I am an L.A. native. I was born in 1966, which is kind of amazing if you think about it. And I was born in a hospital in Hollywood called Cedars of Lebanon, the predecessor to Cedars-Sinai, which has no importance to any of the audience except for the fact that that very building that I was born in became the original Scientology Center. It's a blue building that you drive past on Fountain that has a large, creepy sign. Also, I was not Scott for the first 10 minutes of my life. My name was Irving for the first 10 minutes of my life. So I've had some weird, strange, star-crossed things happen to me from the word go. But I don't think that's as important as what you're going to hear. So let us flash forward to 1983. a very magical time in Los Angeles, especially if you grew up the way that I did, and I had nothing to do with it. It was completely by accident. I happened to be born in the right zip code. But I went to a small private school called Crossroads, which is a little bit famous slash infamous now. And if you went to Crossroads in the early 80s, it was kind of a cool place to be. In other words, we had a lot of fun and there were very few boundaries. We used to smoke pot on the roof. We used to smoke cigarettes in the alley. And the prom party, which, by the way, I never got invited to, was at one of Barbara Streisand's five houses. She used to have five houses, one each based on her mood. And apparently there was so much cocaine at this party that people did not know what to do with it. Now, let me put everything in even more context for you. The drinking age nationally was 18 years old, and no one enforced it, especially not in Los Angeles. Cigarettes were 85 cents a pack, and everyone smoked. There was probably more cocaine going around than marijuana, since it was crossing over from Colombia into Florida at an uncontrollably high rate. Gas was 50 cents, and we got upset when it became 60 cents. Kids drove drunk. There were no airbags, so tons of kids died. It was just a very naive time. It was a time when things were moving very quickly into the future, and adults didn't know what to do with it. And we just sort of, as your host mentioned, had very few parents around. We were sort of left alone. And if you grew up in liberal West LA, you really were left alone at your own devices. Now, being a private school kid, I got introduced to all kinds of things that I had mentioned before very early. I grew up quite fast. And on top of that, I had a very, very sick brother. He had kidney disease. He was on home dialysis. And I have a crazy mother, extremely crazy. So I basically got out and partied as much as I could. That was my release. My two things were drinking a lot and going to punk rock shows. And this story is more about the drinking part. And I'm going to tell you about a crazy night in my life where Hollywood drinking and my 80s childhood intersect. So one night, it's a Saturday night, 1983, and my friends and I decide to go party. And I lived in Santa Monica in the canyons because I'm a lucky kid. And we go to our favorite spot in Malibu, which was a sushi place called Something's Fishy. Terrible title for a restaurant run by a bunch of reprobate Japanese sushi masters who let anyone drink and smoke in their place. They would greet you with this loud kampai, and then you'd be off to the races. So I was 16 years old, and it was the first time I'd ever drank sake. And if anybody's ever drank sake before, you know that shit sneaks up on you. So about three sakes later, I was, I thought I could handle it. You know, even though I was about 5'6", 125 pounds wet, we decided to go up the PCH to one of the many crazy parties that we often got invited to. And in this case, it was a beach house party given by a kid who was a son of some sort of big asshole producer that I don't know anything about. And, as usual, it was like some risky business bullshit scenario where the parents are away in Europe and the kid has the run of the house. And it's this big beach house up near Latigo Canyon. That's way up the coast in Malibu, which is always great to drive to after you've had three sakes. Bunch of us get into my Jeep. We go to this party, and it was just packed. And they had a drinking game in the kitchen. We were playing quarters with Mickey's malt liquor, which is the traditional way that teenagers get drunk because it's cheap and fast. Here's the problem with Mickey's malt liquor. It is a horrible drunk. Like, it's a pirate drunk. Like, it's the kind of drunk that makes you want to set a car on fire and go fuck a tree. It's terrible. Like, if you look at Mickey's, the bottle is just an angry bee with a hammer. So we were playing quarters with Mickey's malt liquor, and I went through three more of those weird jar-type bottles of Mickey's, and I can't believe I wasn't blacking out. I just remembered everything. But I know the room was spinning, and I really, really had to vomit. Every bathroom was taken up in the house. You know, it was just one of those parties that was super packed, And so I kind of ventured upstairs, bouncing off the stairs and the wall into the master bedroom, which had a like a handwritten sign on a piece of paper that said, please don't go in the room. When you were as drunk as I was, you went into the room. And I had to throw up. And the next thing that I did was, I guess, purely on impulse. I had to throw up, and I see these hats that are being displayed in the bedroom on plexiglass, like 4-foot-high plexiglass structures. And needing to throw up, I pick up one of the hats, which was a bowler hat, which I later found out was not just any bowler hat. It was a bowler hat used by the villain Oddjob in the movie Goldfinger. I threw up in this hat, filled it literally to the brim. The hat had a blade on the side, which if you remember Oddjob used to use to like kill people, I should have used that blade to slit my wrists at that point. But it wasn't over, folks. I had to throw up more. So I picked up a straw boater that was on top of a plexiglass display. A straw boater that was used by W.C. Fields. I still had to throw up, so I decided to vomit into a fedora used by Spencer Tracy, apparently, in a 40s film noir. What I'm saying is I really, really like cinema. And if you think about it, comedy works in threes, so that was what you might call a hat trick. And I felt a lot better, so I did what any 16-year-old with any lack of self-respect would do. I went downstairs and played quarters again, because I did not know what the fuck I was doing. Downed a couple more bottles of Mickey's, because I'm terrible at quarters. And then I decided to walk out to the beach. Now, there's a little stairway that goes out to the sand where the beach is. And I tried to walk down the stairs and then fell on my face completely. And that stimulated my peristalsis muscles once more. So I stumbled over to a bonfire, threw up into the bonfire, and extinguished that. Then I threw up my last little bit next to a guy who was breakdancing on a towel with a boombox next to him playing Rocket by Herbie Hancock. And luckily, I did not drive home. Like, somebody had the wisdom to take me home. And I don't know, they were probably almost as drunk as I was. And I get home, and I pass out on the tile bathroom floor. And my dad, who I think even at 45 years old was pretty much of an old Jew, walks up to me, and I look up, just completely hammered. And he's in his bathrobe, and he just has his arms crossed, and he's shaking his head. And he just goes, you should have taken a cab. And that was the end of the night. And I don't know how, like, I went through a couple of these sorts of episodes, and I just don't know how I survived, but I guess I did, and I'm here now. So that's cool, right?
We were saying about it's like you got to let people survive these things.
Well, I know. I mean, and I can't believe some of the things that I survived as well growing up in high school. But I would think, Scott, growing up here in Los Angeles, that, you know, especially the availability of, you know, all the alcohol at the
time,
that's and you're
funny
at the ocean.
Like, you're telling the story about the houses and the cocaine, and you're getting drunk on Mickey's malt liquor, which is what everybody in Wisconsin was doing at the same time.
It was kind of like the high life and the low life at the same time. You know, it was like you pay, and but you have to understand that cocaine, an 8-ball was $20 back then.
Mm-hmm.
It's $150 now. Yeah. Not that I would know anything about cocaine. I think if I did cocaine, I would die.
Mickey's Big Mouth is probably the same price it was back then.
Yeah, worthless.
So
yeah.
Listen, no, it's so interesting though, because growing up in Pittsburgh and Hannes grew up in Milwaukee. I mean, we'd never had anybody in the studio, I don't think anyway, that you know, really grew up in the heart of Santa Monica, going to Crossroads School. Did you go to school with any famous people, as it were, that are now famous?
Well, let me see.
Because there's a caliber of...
Yeah, I mean, it's a great school, and I went to... I had a class of 84 people. Like, I did not have a bully. There are people that are famous from my school, not from my class. I mean, Jack Black.
Maya Rudolph, I just read.
Maya Rudolph. Who's that crazy, like, that girl from New Girl?
Oh, Zooey Deschanel.
Please don't put that in there that I don't know who she is. that girl from New Girl, Zooey Deschanel, she went there.
Yeah, because Crossroads is sort of an upscale school, and it's a private school, as I understand.
Yeah, I think Damon Wayans' kids went there.
So did you grow up wealthy?
Well, Crossroads, when I was going to school there, it was $5,000 a year.
Yeah, it didn't, like now it might be 30 or something.
Yeah, now it's, so we had actually had middle class kids going to school there. I was upper middle class back then. You know, I mean, we lived in a nice place, but don't forget that like in the early 80s, living on the West Side was not nearly as expensive as it is now.
Sure.
You know, everything is just now Pacific Palisades and the West Side are more expensive than Beverly Hills.
Right. It's outrageous. Yeah.
Yeah, it's insane.
As soon as you get close to the ocean, I mean, the prices just skyrocket.
Yeah.
And so did you have any friends or people in your school that died on PCH?
I did. Yeah. I had a buddy named Royal Peterson who died in a fiery, drunken car crash. We played baseball together, and that was really sad.
It's so sad.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, there was actually three or four people from my school that died in drunk driving incidents. I mean, it was pretty unsafe.
Well, now this was always on PCH?
No, there was a thing called Dead Man's Curve, which I think there are a lot of Dead Man's Curves, frankly. Near where I grew up in the Palisades on Sunset, one friend of mine died there, you know.
Is that over by, in Westwood?
No, this is further over near Paul Revere in Riviera Country Club. There was this crazy accident where four kids got drunk and died on San Vicente Boulevard in Brentwood. They ran into one of those giant ficus trees.
Sure.
Which is a weirdly comical way to die, being killed by a ficus tree.
Yeah, that's like it.
I don't know. I think that's just called
you hit a tree. And then the city of Los Angeles outlawed ficus trees. But it's like, yeah, it's just like such a... Yeah, this is why drunk driving was eventually taken seriously, because people used to do it all the time.
Well,
and they would crash all the time.
Kids are horrible drivers. I was a horrible driver. I had this old Jeep I bought and fixed up, and I used to run it along the beach. We'd get drunk and run it along the beach.
You mean like, drive the Jeep on the sand?
Yeah, drive the Jeep on the sand. I almost go, but nobody would arrest you back then. You know, here's the weirdness of the world. When I was in ninth grade, there was a teacher who was having a sexual relationship with a student. And the rumors were going around, and everybody kind of knew about it.
Yeah.
But it was kind of tolerated. Now that guy would be in jail for 20 years.
Well, now people would know about it.
And they would report him.
Right now they would. But back then, you know, there wasn't the speed of the internet or texting or Snapchat.
Also, there was like a weirdly moral gray area back then. And now everything's much more black and white. And I don't think that's wrong necessarily. I mean,
we were uneducated maybe. And now we know more information.
Oh, yeah, you know, and also, I think, and this is improved, I had three friends of mine who were closeted gay men, mm-hmm. and very angry, and justifiably so, for having to live that life, but, like, they had to live, you know, in the shadows, man, and now 15-year-old kids can come out, and I think that's awesome.
Yeah, they truly had to be closeted.
Oh, yeah, they didn't come out until they were in, you know, college.
I'm sorry, people, that just makes me think of that guy Michael Sam, the first drafted gay NFL player, openly gay player. And it's like there's people who are like, this is outrageous. It's like, you're all going to die.
Yeah, what off. Is
it? Like, no one's going to remember this shit in 100 years. Yeah.
Right,
somebody said to me, it's like the way we're looking at like what black people couldn't use the same, you know, drinking fountain. It's like people are going to look at this and go, what are you fucking talking about? What was your problem with gay people getting
gay
married?
Gay marriage with marijuana, with a lot of things. Well, people are going to look back in 20 years, 30 years and say...
Here's my question. If he doesn't make the team, what are they going to do with all those jerseys they're trying to sell? They've made, like, they're actually cashing in on the Michael Sam thing, which is cool, whatever, you know.
That's interesting.
No, they're actually, like, turning this... It's funny because it used to be commercial suicide to have that happen, and now, like...
Well, I just read that he's got his own reality show coming up.
Oh, boy.
Good for him, man.
The Oprah Winfrey Network.
Good for him.
Like, and let me ask you something. The house that you were at that night, it's very funny, the image of the plexiglass displays, because I can totally picture, like, on an awards show, how they would have the display on top. And so that's what you're talking about?
Yeah, well, what happened in the 80s, it was very in to make these plexiglass boxes that were different heights. Like, my parents lived in a pretty, like, modern house, and they had one of those, and they had this weird plastic giant heavy disc that would sit on it that was, like, really thin that we would knock down all the time.
So it was like a plate that's...
Yeah, just a plate that balanced on this thing.
And that's art. That was their art.
Yeah, that was art. I mean, what was modern art in the 80s was pretty amazing.
Yeah, that's very funny.
Like, that was the age of Patrick Nagel portraits, those that every kid had in their dorm room.
Right.
He was the guy that drew the naked leg.
Yes,
really right. Miami Vice looking shit. Yeah.
Yeah.
And what was
your
family's business in? What were they in?
Well, my mom is a very talented artist. She's a painter, and she had a studio in downtown LA before anybody thought it was cool to go down there. She was way cool before its time, man.
Yeah.
And my dad did what's called real estate syndicating, and to this day, I couldn't tell you what the hell it is, but it seems like it's honest, and no one got killed doing it.
So they seem like they were pretty open-minded people.
Yeah. You know, my parents are New York refugees, as it were, who left screwed up families and just became sort of rebellious, liberal, almost by rebellion, if that makes any sense, you know, very open-minded.
Yeah.
They were depression-era people, you know, but my dad was borderline inappropriate with his liberality, if that makes any sense.
Really?
Yeah, I mean,
they were born in the Depression in the 30s and...
My dad was born in 1929, but you have to understand, my dad worked on a kibbutz in Israel, and that's kind of a crazy thing to do in the early 50s, you know?
Yeah,
that was considered
why was he inappropriate with liberality? That sounds...
He's like, when are you going to get laid, kid, when I was 15 years old? When I was 16 years old, he wanted to take me to Vegas.
Yeah.
And I didn't want to go with him because I was 16 and couldn't deal with my father. And I found out later that he was taking me to Vegas to get me set up with a hooker so I would lose my virginity.
Wow.
Which sounds crazy, but that's what they did back in the old days, is they would take you to a whorehouse.
No, I've never heard that.
Former guest.
I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No. We had Ron Zimmerman on.
Oh, whose uncle took him to a whorehouse? Right,
His uncle said, "Listen, here's the directions to the whorehouse in rural, wherever they're
in
Indiana."
I'm mistaken. I'm thinking when you said the old days, I'm thinking of the 80s, but you're talking about when he was born in the 30s and the 40s.
Yeah, like I have a feeling that's what his dad did for him.
In the 40s.
Yeah, in the 40s. So like he just wanted me to just get over the sex thing really quickly, you know, because... I was the typical, like, awkward, chubby teenager, and he just wanted me to, I guess, in his own weird way.
Did you get over it?
The sex thing?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, when I was 19.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
with a girlfriend, in college.
Yeah, like a consenting person.
Yeah, like with a normal, healthy relationship and not some weird, hotel room in Vegas in the 80s, which is, 80s Vegas was super sleazy.
I'm going to defend your father. First of all, he was going to take you to Vegas. He could have gone to, you know, State Line or Laughlin or something.
No, dad's classy, man.
At some low end or maybe just in Riverside. But no, he's going to take you all the way to Vegas.
Was he
going
to take you to the Bunny Ranch?
Hooker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, like I got to say, like, they were sitting in the lobby. It wasn't hard to find a hooker, you know?
Oh,
like,
wow.
Yeah. And my dad traveled over 200 days out of the year. He was basically a traveling salesman. So I hardly ever saw.
Your dad was Willie Loman. Wow.
He was Willie Loman, except really good at what he did and successful.
except for he doesn't fail and kill himself.
Yeah.
Again, but
yeah. Not
that,
sad. Yeah. But like, you wonder, because my mom is I love my mother, but she's kind of intolerable, frankly. I always wonder if my dad was fucking around on the road. I don't blame him if he was. You know, like, that was the life.
Why do you wonder that? You just...
First of all, it's something I have discussed with my therapist. And also, like, I just think that you're gone that many days on the road. I just think it's... almost unnatural not to, in a way.
Monogamy is in a way unnatural.
I think so. I believe so.
Now, do you travel as a comedian?
I used to, but I don't anymore. I'm transitioning into being a writer and working in a writer's room because I like that life more.
Right. Did you ever fool around on the road as such?
Sure.
Sure.
It's easy.
With a girlfriend at home?
I did. Yeah, I did. I was in a relationship 3 years ago and it wasn't going very well, actually. Yeah. When I was on the road for about 2 weeks. And, Yeah, I mean, I strayed, absolutely.
Did you ever tell the girl about it? Or
no, yeah. I did not. I mean, I'm not proud of it. I don't think it was nice, but, right. You know.
Well, sometimes to then admit it later is just to hurt somebody purposefully, whereas you could just keep it inside and know yourself you're an asshole, but not have to tell that other person.
Well, that's one of the many ways I know I'm an asshole.
No, but
I could create a list for you if you want.
As it were.
Yeah, we don't have, yeah, we're going to need a paper list.
Do you have brothers and sisters, Scott?
I had a brother who passed away in 1988.
I heard you say the kidney disease, and what was that?
Well, my brother Peter was born with a strange congenital kidney disease where his antibodies attacked his kidneys. So he lost his kidneys. We went through several unsuccessful transplants. And so I grew up with a very sick, angry brother, justifiably so. We didn't get along very well because of that. And he needed constant care, and he really was robbed of his childhood. And I feel terrible now because he would have been in his 40s. It would have been nice to have a brother. But, you know, we had that struggle going on. My parents had to deal with that cross to bear. And then in 1988, we lost him very suddenly, which is just a horrible thing for my parents.
I am so sorry. That's a horrible thing.
Yeah, it's a rough thing for me, but it was rougher for him and my parents, frankly.
Sure. You know? Mm-hmm. And so then your parents probably put a lot into you. I mean, it's reminding me of that movie, Ordinary People, you know?
My growing up was quite a bit like Ordinary People,
right.
I would say.
Yeah. I can see that because there's a dynamic going on of you're the well child, so you should be grateful that you're well.
Uh-huh.
But at the same time, you know, what about giving you some energy? You know, it sounded like they just wanted to push you up and out.
Yeah, they did. They were pretty thrilled when I left for school in Massachusetts because it was one less thing for them to have to think about. I mean, I'm sure that they, in their own way, they cared about me.
Of course.
But and also, you have to understand, they're not the most emotionally evolved people. And I think a lot of that is generational because they were the first generation Americans with crazy immigrant parents, like Russian and Polish immigrants who had gone through horrible things. And so
did they come through Ellis Island?
Yes. My father's father, Sydney, came in 1899 at 12 years old to Ellis Island.
Wow.
And my mother's mother also came through Ellis Island. Yeah. And her father, too.
Wow.
Yeah. So we're talking like real like first generation Americans.
Did they really call you Irving?
Yeah.
Why'd they do that?
It was my dad who wanted to name me after my cousin. It was his uncle. So I guess, is that a cousin? I don't remember.
But why did they change it, I meant? Why did they
Irving, first of all, my mother changed it because, like, that name is Jewier than a Torah scroll made of bagels. And it's a tough deal to go through life as Irving Boxenbaum.
Yeah.
You know, also, I think it's like that assimilation thing where you want to give your kid a regular, quote unquote, American name.
Right.
So everybody from my generation was Scott or Matt.
My brother's
or David.
Name is Scott. Yeah.
Yeah. Peter, you know. So you want to kind of blend in a little bit more.
And I think, like the name Scott. It's a good name.
I appreciate that. Thank you. Thank you. Thank you.
Scott, no, it's like on Star Trek, all the hero names have K sounds in them.
Oh,
Kirk,
yeah.
Picard. Riker, Spock. So, like, yeah, you want a K sound. See, I don't have a K sound. I could have been.
Is that your problem?
I could have been an astronaut.
That's what the problem
is.
Yeah.
K sound.
Interesting.
Yeah, exactly.
Hey, Scott, you want to play some Shotgun Storyworthy?
Hell yeah, I do.
That music can only mean one thing. It's time for Shotgun Storyworthy.
The game where our storyteller spins the Storyworthy Wheel of Truth and tells a true one-minute story about the topic it lands on.
So everybody, say it with me.
Spin that wheel!
The story topic is hired. And this is about the first job I ever got, which was for a punk rock record label that was famous for about a few years, called SST Records. They had bands like Black Flag and the Minutemen and the Meat Puppets. And I remember going to the meeting with my would-be boss, Greg Ginn, and he was like, are you going to use this as SST University? And I was like, yes, I am. I'm going to use the information and take it and start my own record company, which I did not do. But I still got hired anyway. And for about 2 years, I worked at SST doing all kinds of stuff. I had to drive down to Carson where the warehouse was. And they always thought I was the weirdo because I was like the rich kid from the Palisades. And all these guys were sort of like these San Pedro working class punk rockers. I was one of the first like college educated people that they hired.
Right on.
Yeah. So, yeah. So screw you, working class people.
Yeah, yeah.
That's a great story. Yeah. See, I like that about Shotgun because, you know, he lands on hired and then he can go right to the job. He knows what he's going to talk about.
Yeah, exactly. First job always comes. That's always what people go to.
Yeah. And so was that your introduction into punk music?
I grew up around that music. I was fortunate enough to grow up in the early 80s and I had friends who introduced me to all kinds of cool things. And when I was in college at Brandeis, I worked at the radio station. I was a music director, and I just kind of became obsessed and a record collector. And I really didn't know what the hell I wanted to do when I got out of college. I knew I wasn't going to be a doctor or a lawyer. So it was kind of logical for me to work in the music business. And so I wanted to work in an indie label and then start my own label. SST seemed very logical to me. I did an internship, and I loved it. And you know, I ended up on my first job making $3.75 an hour.
Wow.
How's that? Yeah. That was like cheapo even by 1988 standards.
Punk music has a lot of anger in it, and maybe that was stemming from your house or...
Anger, passion, raw, a lot of fun. I had a good time with it, you know.
Where were the shows? What were the gigs that you would go to out here? Was this like up on the strip with the Whiskey and the Rainbow? And
no, that was where the heavy metal, like, people were. They were the hair metal folks that were up on the strip.
So where were the punk people?
Okay, so the punk clubs were in the like the skranky area of Hollywood Boulevard, which is all sort of getting gentrified. The club that I used to go to on 1600 Argyle across from what is now the W Hotel was called the Cathay de Grand.
Mm-hmm.
And it was a kind of a basement-y punk club, super unsafe to be inside. Guys like selling drugs on the corner and everything. And you'd go to see Black Flag, X, the Minutemen.
Wow.
Yeah. And then there was another place that I used to go to called Al's Bar downtown on Traction, which is below the American Hotel.
Wow.
And that was downtown in the, you know, in the '80s. It was pretty crazy. It was a guy outside and he'd be like, hey, man, I watch a car. And you'd give him a couple bucks to watch your car, not wash it. And if you didn't give him a couple of bucks, he would just break into your car.
Oh,
and
my
take your stuff. So it was that adventure.
The 80s, downtown Los Angeles in the 80s was very dangerous, right?
Yeah, it was pretty nasty
down
there.
Yeah, they're trying to say like it's all wonderful now. There's still plenty of bad spots downtown.
But it's a lot better. Yeah.
Well, all the bougie people are moving down there, so they're pushing the homeless further east. But the homeless
The what people?
Bougie, that's a term
that
B-O-O-J-I-E, I believe. That's a term that the youngins.
Bourgeois,
that's a term that the youngins use to say.
I'm going to start using that.
Yeah.
You watch
Bougie's
me.
Awesome. Yeah.
You watch me. I'll do it.
You're too bougie to use the word bougie.
So I'm trying to be like the kids, man. But the thing is, like, there was Raji's. Raji's was great. That was where I got my car stolen. Raji's now parking lot.
Should have given the guy a couple of bucks. I don't know what your problem
was. It was like there was just glass on the corner. There's a parking lot. I think it's a parking lot for where the Henry Fonda Theater is. And then there was the Gaslight, which is where the Ivar Theater is now.
So this is all dead center Hollywood.
Dead center Hollywood. It's all past history. It's all been blown away by the winds of time.
Remember the Coconut Teaser?
Used to go to Coconut Teaser all the time.
That's one club I do remember of going to see music.
Laurel Canyon and Sunset.
Yeah, and I did comedy there too. That's
I remember the comedy at the Coconut Teaser.
In the basement. Very dark.
Yeah, I mean, there was also a place on Pico Boulevard in the middle of nowhere, kind of like past mid-city, which I guess is West Adams, called Jabberjaw in the 90s, which was awesome.
Yeah.
Where else did I go? Club 88.
Well, it's just interesting talking to an L.A. native, you know, because you see things come and you see things go and you see how things change.
Oh, yeah.
You see the real estate, you know, go up and it's interesting.
Well, there are half as many people in L.A. as there are now. And I remember change even when I came back from college in 88. It was like, holy shit, there's traffic. I mean, L.A. was just so provincial.
You're saying the population of L.A. has doubled in the past 30 years.
Oh, yeah.
Absolutely. Wow. There's still being a push west now, as you know. I mean, if you think of how many people were in Los Angeles in 1950 versus how many people were in New York in 1950, I mean, it's vastly different. I mean, people were still really, and they still are,
so
coming
west.
So
just stop it, people. Listen, stay you're out there, you're listening to us, you're like, I want to be in show business. Stop it.
No, you don't.
Just stay where you are. You can do a podcast in your hometown.
It's a
you
pretty crappy fucking
here.
Business.
Leave us alone.
It's a shitty ass. I'm in it. We're all in it. And the only good part of it is the ability to do it. The rest of it can suck it.
I like that. I'm going to use that as one
That's
of our
sound bites. Yeah, cool. All right.
If
well, I appreciate that.
If you want it, you will get it.
Right. Exactly. And by the way, a teacher once told me the absence of yes over time means no.
Whoa.
Oh, that is deep.
Take that shit in, man.
Oh, God. Oh, my gosh.
I need some cocaine.
All right, you
That's
guys.
That's my career, the absence
we're gonna
of yes.
We're going to wrap it up right about now. Thank you very much, Scott.
Sweet.
Box
Thank
Mom,
you.
For
Thank you, guys.
Coming on the show. Oh, wait, real quick. Whose house was it that you were in? I meant to ask that.
I totally don't remember.
Just
I
a producer
swear
guy.
To God. Yeah, some like producer guy that's probably dead now.
Who collects hats and puts them on plexiglass.
Probably
stands.
Fucking dead now.
Excellent.
Yeah.
He probably died when he saw the hat full of vomit. He didn't survive that.
Nobody ever found out that I was the guy who did it.
They didn't test your vomit?
No vomit testing, and
yes,
I did not exploit it for fame, for purposes of fame.
Yes.
Well, that's I find that very respectable.
Well, yeah, I've prostituted myself in all kinds of ways in the last 25 years, so don't worry about it. All right.
Thank you for coming.
Thanks. Bye.
All right, thank you guys. You. I want to thank everybody here at Sideshow Network, including Anthony Bench and Sean Merrick. And, of course, you know John Thomas Griffith.
Never heard of him.
That's the guy that wrote our theme song, Follow Me. And on behalf of our storyteller tonight, Scott Boxenbaum, and, of course, you, Hannes Finney, my dear friend and co-host, my name is Christine Blackburn, saying, make it a story-worthy week. Yeah, you can.
Thanks for joining us on the Storyworthy Podcast. We'll be back next week with all new stories. Subscribe to Storyworthy on iTunes and visit the Storyworthy website at storyworthypodcast.com.
If you like listening to comedy, try watching it on the internet. The folks behind the Sideshow Network have launched a new YouTube channel called Wait For It. It's got interviews with comedians like Reggie Watts, Todd Glass, Liza Schlesinger, I've been friends with her for 10 years, one of the funniest people out there, and I still have a hard time with the last name, Liza. Our very own Owen Benjamin, that's me, takes you on a musical journey down internet rabbit holes and much more. You don't have to wait any longer. Just go to youtube.com/waitforitcomedy. There's no need to wait for it anymore. Because it's here. And it's funny. And I love you.